Morning, members. We have a quorum. We have Representative Wilkin. Would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would. I'd move that House File 1003 be recommended to pass and re-refer to jobs,
government
economic opportunity, policy, and finance.
Government ops, you mean?
Or gov ops. Why? There's a, I'm told there, because there's a fee in it. There's a fee in it, so it would have to go to a finance committee. I don't know why it would go to gov ops.
Whatever you say.
Well, if the CA has heard otherwise.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll go to Representative Gunther's committee.
Thank you. Proceed.
Okay, let's start off by adopting the DE2 amendment. That'll get it in the shape that we want to discuss it. So I'd move the DE2.
Any discussion on that DE2 amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
2-0.
Go ahead and proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm going to let Pete Train go through the bill for us and explain exactly what we're doing.
Representative Wilkin, excuse me one second. Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe any of us have a copy, at least on this end, have a copy of the amendment that was just
the DE2?
Presented. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Let's make sure everybody gets to see that first.
And, well, while they're passing it out, Mr. Chairman, just so members know, the other bill, the other Wilkin bill, is was not ready for prime time, so it's maybe Tuesday. So just so members know, we've only got 3 bills on schedule for today. I'm sure that'll break everybody up.
Representative Wilkin, could you explain the amendment, the DE2 amendment?
Well, the DE2 is the actual bill now, so we'll let Mr. Thrain go through it.
Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Peter Thrain, and together with my colleague Paul Cassidy, we represent the Service Contract Industry Council. The SCIC is a nationwide trade group of providers, sellers, manufacturers of service contracts. Our members include 80% of the sellers of service contracts across the country, and it's over 40 members. Common members would include companies as diverse as General Electric, Aon, CNA, and Sears. Thank you for the opportunity to, on behalf of the SCIC, to testify on behalf of this important legislation. Service contracts, sometimes called extended service warranties, provide for the repair or replacement of merchandise, appliances, or systems. They provide coverage for defects in material and workmanship, sometimes called breakdowns. They don't provide sort of insurance protections, and those are the things such as external risks, such as the perils of fire, loss, or theft. Interesting enough, most service contracts are not regulated in the state of Minnesota. A Minnesotan has no regulatory assurance that the promises made under a service contract will be performed by the provider. House File 1003 provides Minnesotans with a number of important consumer protections, most notably ensuring the strong financial capability of the provider to assure that providers honor the promises made in service contracts. Minnesota, interestingly, is one of only about 15 states that have not adopted a comprehensive service contract legislation. 12 states, including New York and Texas, have adopted the NAIC Model Act, the act upon which this is passed, and over half of the balance of the states have adopted some other variety of comprehensive legislation. This legislation would make Minnesota law consistent with the vast number of states, providing important consumer protections, and by providing a fair and certain regulatory framework, encouraging service contract providers to compete in Minnesota. As you will hear from Buzz Anderson from the Minnesota Retailers Association, ensuring the integrity of service contract providers and a broad choice of providers is important to Minnesota retailers selling service contracts. Let me take a few moments and walk through the bill and walk through the DE2 amendment and explain the key provisions. Section 1 sets forth some exceptions from this legislation, and there are some key exceptions. For example, auto service contracts are exempted from this legislation because they're regulated under another section of state law. Service contracts dealing with consumer goods valued less than $250 are not covered, simply as a matter of reasonable trying to draw a line there. Service contracts sold to businesses are not covered, would not be covered by this legislation. In addition, service contracts sold by certain public utilities are also not covered by the legislation. Section 2 provides a series of definitions, and the definitions are important. I'd be happy to answer any questions about those definitions, but they are fairly self-explanatory. The key provisions in this bill, I believe, are found in Section 3. Section 3 deals with the key financial protections, and that's to make sure that there is the financial support behind the provider to ensure the provider can finance the obligations made under a service contract. Today, there are no financial requirements upon a service contract provider. Service contract provider can enter the market without any assurance that there's financial backing to support the obligations and commitments they're making in this bill, they're making in their service contract. This bill provides strong and tough financial requirements to ensure that those service contract obligations can be met. And they can be met in one of three ways. A provider, that's the seller of the contract, can purchase a reimbursement insurance policy from a licensed insurer, a surplus lines insurer, or a risk retention group to guarantee the performance of those service contract obligations. In the event the provider doesn't perform those obligations, the consumer, by this legislation, is provided with an opportunity to cut through to the provider and go right to the reinsurance and reimbursement policy. By having a licensed insurer required to do this, we're providing strong financial regulation for insurance companies to back the provider's obligations. In addition, we increase the minimum capital and surplus requirements from that required by Minnesota law, $2, $3, or $4 million, to $10 and $15 million, to make sure that all providers, all insurers entering this market, have strong financial protection. A provider can also support their obligations by maintaining a reserve of the amount of fee collected to support the payment of claims. A portion of that fee would be placed in a trust that would be regulated by the Department of Commerce, and it would be secured either by securities or a letter of credit. Again, strong financial protection to make sure that the provider is capable of performing their obligation. And the third way a provider can support the payment of their obligations is by the issuance of, by a provider with over $100 million in net worth. And $100 million in net worth with disclosures to the Department of Commerce in their SEC filings to demonstrate that they have $100 million in net worth to support those obligations. Such a provider could use an affiliate, but the provider must guarantee the affiliate's obligations. These three obligations, these three opportunities provide strong financial protection for providers issuing service contracts. In addition to these protections, under Section 3, a provider is required to register with the commissioner, a registration that is not provided today. The bill also provides a number of key consumer protections. In Sections 3 and going forward, and I'll highlight the key ones, Section 3 requires the provider give the consumer a receipt for the purchase of the contract and the contract within a reasonable period of time after the purchase. That's Section 3, Subdivision 1. Section 3, Subdivision 5 requires the provider to allow the consumer to return the contract within 20 days of the mailing or 10 days of delivery if delivered with the sale, with a full return of the purchase price if a claim hasn't been made. This is a right of rescission. If somebody changes their mind and there's not been a claim incurred, they can return the contract for a full return of the purchase price. Section 4 requires disclosure of whether or not the contract is supported by a reinsurance reimbursement policy and inform the consumer of the consumer's right to make a direct claim under the insurance policy. Section 5, I'll just highlight, provides a number of disclosures. The contract must be printed in clear and understandable language. It must contain all the required disclosures, state the name and address of the provider, the administrator, the seller, and the consumer. disclose the purchase price and the terms under which it is sold, disclose whether there are any deductibles, any restrictions upon the transfer, set forth note requirements and terms of termination, the duties of the contract holder, and any exclusions, a substantial number of disclosures and requirements. In addition, Section 7 includes some enforcement provisions, including prohibitions upon using certain names. These aren't insurance policies. They're not to be issued. They are not issued. These contracts are not insurance. It sets forth they're not to say they're insurance. Also, Section 12 sets forth service contract claim handling standards. These are provisions that are above and beyond the requirements of the model law, those standards. I should also, once again, this legislation provides an effective and measured regulatory framework for regulating service contracts, a regulatory framework that doesn't exist in Minnesota and in a dwindling number of states. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill. We'd be happy to answer any questions. And, Mr. Chairman, I understand that the retailers would like to testify in this bill as well. Thank you.
Representative Simpson.
To the testifier, I was just curious. You had indicated that utility companies are not included in this. If I'm not mistaken, we have a lot of them selling services for appliances and sort. Why have you chosen not to put them in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, utility contracts and the original NAIC model draft, they're not contemplated within the draft of that legislation because there is a broad range of regulation of utilities generally. So consequently, the NAIC did not contemplate those. We've tuned it in Minnesota to make it more applicable to Minnesota. Consequently, they're not included within the scope of this bill.
And should they be? I guess that'd be my next question. How much of this is happening, and is this an item that should be?
Mr. Fine.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, it's my understanding that these companies have been in this business for a long time, and that I'm not aware of issues arising under those kinds of contracts.
Thank you.
Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and guests. I guess the question that arrives in my mind is, what's the problem that's trying to be solved, that you're trying to solve here? You know, I understand this is based on a model law, as you explained, but, you know, why is this coming up now?
Mr. Thrain.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a good question. There's a number of values to this legislation. One is that we've been fortunate. I'm not aware of any major failure of service contract provider in Minnesota. There have been states that have had failures, and since there is no regulation at all, there's very little recourse for the people that rely upon those contracts. That's number one. Number two, there's a lack of certainty in Minnesota law. There are providers that are concerned about entering Minnesota because there isn't a consistent, clear, and understandable regulatory framework. So there's a view that there's a lack of competition because there isn't certainty. It's not clear whether or not this product would be regulated as insurance. There's an argument that it is. There's an equal argument that it isn't. And this provides certainty so the providers can understand the requirements, enter Minnesota, compete. And also, it obviously protects consumers from issues that have fortunately not happened here, but have happened in other states.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
My name is Pete Frank.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Frank. My question was just, you gave a few examples of the types of companies that provide these service contracts. Are they all large companies, or are there also small businesses that provide service contracts, and how would this legislation affect them? Would it be very difficult for these small businesses to comply?
Mr. Thrain.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, our members tend to be the larger members. This legislation, though, I believe, is calibrated to address their concerns. And as Buzz Anderson from the Realtor is going to test, having a credible financial backing for the product is critical for the retailer. So a retailer actually could be a provider and register as a provider. They'd need to purchase the insurance policy, which is probably the most likely course of doing that. They could also segregate their assets in the form of reserves. But I think this makes it in some ways easier for a smaller party to enter the market because there's this big financial entity called an insurance company from whom they could buy an insurance policy to facilitate their doing this business.
Yeah, Buzz Anderson, go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Buzz Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association. I want to thank the chair for his indulgence and thank the author for his indulgence in working with us on this bill. Again, I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association, and I want to talk a little bit about the retail perspective on this. Retailers have a lot to deal with, just like all of us in today's society. They have a lot of things that they're always trying to anticipate. You know, what's the economy going to be like? What kind of consumer trends are happening? What's happening with technology? And, of course, one of the big questions that a lot of people are always going through their head in businesses is the arena that we're most involved in, but they are not. And Representative Simpson probably has a different perspective now than he did before he came to the legislature. But retailers oftentimes aren't involved with business and regulation or the formation thereof. And so retailers are usually very good at trying to anticipate all of these other things, but it's very difficult for them to anticipate what's the result of legislation going to be or what is the anticipated regulation that might be being drafted and what potential impact might that have on their business. Well, a prime example of this is the whole service contract issue. There's a great deal of ambiguity in Minnesota law, and some would argue that service contracts are regulated and some would argue that they're not. And I think what we're just trying to do here is to do what they've done in a whole number of other states, and that is clarify the ambiguity, to say that in fact service contracts will be regulated, but they'll all be regulated from state to state in the same manner following the Model Act. That's why we're supporting this, and that's why we commend Representative Wilkin for doing this. It clears up that ambiguity, and now retailers will know what to expect in terms of what's required of them under regulation, and they can be assured that their customers and consumers will be able to know that, hey, we understand that the force of law and the Department of Commerce stands behind the requirements of these regulations. So again, it's something other states have done. We think it's a reasonable and a pragmatic approach to providing reasonable but modest regulation and consistency in the law, which now has a great deal of ambiguity. And I would ask you to support the legislation. And thank you, Mr. Chair. We're glad to answer any questions.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Anderson, I also agree with you. I think it'll be good for retailers, and I think that's a good thing. The chief reason, though, that I signed on as a co-author was because as I understand the current law, there is no current law to protect consumers. Unfortunately, we've been lucky not to have anybody go belly up as a service contract provider in Minnesota. But it does concern me, especially as I go to Best Buy and you go to other places and it's just one service contract after another that's being offered. And my concern, the reason I approached it, Representative Liebling, I think, hit it on the head, is it's kind of like a vaccine. I hope we never have a problem, but I still get my kids vaccinated against certain diseases. This could be a terrible disease if it happens in Minnesota and it affect consumers worst of all. What I understand the bill requires is financial solvency, number one. You get a right of rescission. Right now, you don't have that right in Minnesota right now. You get 20 days to think about it. If you don't like it, you go back, you get a full refund. And best of all, it's got disclosure language, so you actually know what you're getting. And I'm a little concerned with some of the service contracts that I've seen out there in the market these days you don't really know the actual price that you're paying. You don't know necessarily what the coverages are that you're buying. You don't know what the cancellation terms might be. And that all concerns me. So I think it's a terrific piece of consumer protection legislation, and I'm a little surprised that it took us until now to do it with the huge ballooning of the number of service contracts that are being offered in Minnesota. So I do think it's a good thing, I'm glad it's good for retailers too.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond.
Yeah.
You know, Representative Atkins, I've always thought of you and Representative Wilkin as being consumer advocates, so I thank you for being a co-author. Not anything in jest, but seriously, there are some conflicting attorney general's opinions from the past that talk about this issue and whether or not this type of activity is regulated, and they go back to the 1960s, maybe the 50s. There's also some conflicting opinions by commissioners of commerce as to whether or not it's regulated, and and there's some difference of opinion if some retailers versus other retailers need to fall under what would then be considered regulation by the Department of Commerce. I think this clears up all that ambiguity and at the same time provides reasonable protection for consumers. So I thank you for your comments and I appreciate your support.
Representative Goodwin.
Question. I'm sorry, I haven't been able to concentrate on this as much, but I'm just wondering, and it's that you've gone through this, but how come there's so many exclusions here, warranties, maintenance agreements? What does it actually end up covering then? What's
the
what kind of service contracts?
There are no mandatory coverage requirements set forth in the bill. They are required, though, to clearly set forth the terms of coverage. Obviously, it's commercially important that they do provide coverage.
But I know that. What kind of service contracts does it cover?
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. Could you restate your question so I make sure I answer the correct question?
That's a good one.
What kind of service contracts? I'm seeing that your warranties, maintenance agreements, service contracts, or maintenance agreements offered by public utilities. There's a lot of exclusions, so I'm wondering what. What does it finally come down to? Is there just one specific type of...
Yeah.
Mr. Thrain.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you for clarifying that. I'm sorry I misunderstood your question. It covers service contracts purchased by consumers on goods with a value of $250 or more, not including auto contracts, which are regulated in a robust system of regulation elsewhere, and those that are offered by public utilities. It's interesting, Mr. Chairman, it's interesting when other states have enacted this, they have approximately between 100 and 180 registered providers in the system. So there is a lot of offering for this and obviously a lot of demand for contracts that fit this category.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm not clear about this because you said 250 or more, but that excludes auto contracts, service contracts with for your automobile. And it also excludes all maintenance agreements. So I still don't get what products or what service would this cover.
Mr. Thrain.
The example would be if you went to a retail location such as a Best Buy, you bought a consumer good with a value of more than $250, you purchased a service contract on that offered coverage beyond the warranty provided by the product, that would be the product that would be covered by this bill. That could be a appliance in your home. It could be a computer. It could be any variety of a radio, stereo, consumer electronic good.
That's a good one.
But then that would be a maintenance agreement as well. I mean, they could argue by this language that it didn't cover, this language doesn't cover them because that's a maintenance agreement or a warranty on the product. So I... That would be either a warranty or a maintenance agreement, or an extended warranty it would be. But so those things wouldn't be covered then.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you asked good questions. There are definitions and careful definitions of maintenance agreements, which is a contract that provides specific scheduled maintenance. It doesn't provide for the repair or replacement of a defective or damaged product. There's also a similar definition for a warranty, which is an agreement that's issued by a first party, a manufacturer, somebody that builds the good, that provides a warranty together with that good. And that product is regulated by the federal Magnuson-Moss Act. So this deals, again, with sales of merchandise, appliances, and so forth, with a value of $250 or more.
Okay. I would call that a warranty, Mr. Chair, but... I'm an appliance. I would call that a warranty from the manufacturer, and that is obviously eliminated here, so I still don't see what it would cover.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilkins.
When you go into Best Buy and you buy a new dishwasher, it's worth $300 or something. I buy this low end. I'm sure you're shocked. But that'll come with it. We'll have a manufacturer's warranty, but often they'll sell you for whatever electronic piece of stuff. They'll sell you an extended kind of warranty. So a lot of times you get to the register and they'll say, "Do you want to buy the extra warranty piece?" That's what we're covering.
To that point.
Thank you.
Representative Atkins.
I don't mean to interrupt Representative Goodwin. The only thing that surprised this end of the table is that you bought new.
There's some truth in
that. Representative Wilkins, do you have another testifier?
I don't think anyone else, unless someone else wants to testify.
Is there anybody in opposition to this bill that wants to testify? Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Lieberman.
Thank you. I just have a question, I guess, about the exclusion here for the parent company maintaining a net worth of $100 million. And I'm just trying to walk myself through this about where that comes from. And I gather that maybe you could just help me out by kind of walking me through again. When is it? Let me just leave it there. Could you just real quickly kind of walk through that section again?
Sure.
The different requirements?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are three ways that a service contract can be supported or financed by a provider. One way is the insurance we talked about. The second is the reserve fund we talked about. And the third is if the provider has a net worth of greater than $100 million, that provider, then their net worth is viewed as sufficient to support the terms of the contract.
Okay, and follow up. I guess I'm a little bit troubled by that. And I guess the reason is, maybe you can put my fears to rest here a little bit, but, you know, I go back to the Enron situation. You know, these days, just because somebody has a net worth that's high doesn't mean that they're particularly stable, solvent. You know, we may not really know what's behind those numbers. And so I guess I don't consider that a real protection factor. You know, maybe a few years ago I might have said, oh, sure, you know, that's a big company and they're stable. But I guess I don't really feel that way anymore, and I'd like your comments on that.
Mr. Drain.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I understand your comment. The first point I'd make is that $100 million of net worth is a very large company. So a company that was in trouble at some point will drift, would seemingly, before this net worth requirement. The second point I'd make is the Department of Commerce will regulate those financial disclosures to make certain those companies, in fact, do have that net worth by reviewing the documents here, the securities and exchange documents that would be required to be filed. And the third point I would make is there's a tremendous amount of additional rigor right now in the securities area around making sure that there are disclosures so that companies that are disclosing this variety of net worth or any net worth are accurately doing it, and we don't have those sorts of issues that took place. The Federal Sarbanes-Oxley legislation really supports this $100 million in net worth requirement.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Wilkins renews his motion at House File 1003, as amended, pass and be referred to Jobs and Economic Opportunity. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. We've got one housekeeping thing that we need to do as a committee. Yesterday we had House File 1521. That was Representative Hamilton's bill. There's a new fee from the Board of Electricity involved there, so that the proper motion was recommended to pass and re-refer to Jobs and Economic Opportunity, Policy and Finance. So this was unanimous yesterday, so all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Well, what you do, all the ones bring it.
Okay, we were just having a little debate about that last motion. I think what we need to do is technically we need to reconsider the motion from yesterday. The bill is still in our possession, so we'll reconsider it and then we'll repass to the correct committee. So all in favor of reconsidering the motion to pass House File 1521, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Hamilton moves that House File 1521 be recommended to pass and re-refer to Which one? Jobs and Economic Opportunity Policy and Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Klinzing. Representative Goodwin, you want to move this bill? You're on the bill, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay,
Representative
Goodwin moves that House File 1929 be recommended to pass and re-refer to State Government Finance. Representative Clinton. Is that right?
Where are you getting this? Mr. Chair, I'd have to... Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, why, but... this bill's been sent a lot of places, so...
What's one more?
we'll work on that while we go over the bill, and we'll confirm that you need to go there, and... There's a fiscal impact with a fee, so I ask to go through a finance committee.
Because we're charging a fee?
Yep.
Okay. Right.
So we're good to go on that. Representative Klinzing, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. What this bill does is establishes a minimum standard of competency for individuals who are going to be inspecting newly constructed buildings in the state of Minnesota. Currently, the city building officials are licensed. However, they might have a number of inspectors who work beneath them, for whom there isn't a minimum standard of competency across the state that's been established. So this would just require an examination and then a small number of continuing education credits after they've passed that examination and then continue on with the job. And I do have a couple testifiers today to talk about it who work in the trenches every day and do this for a living and their reasons for supporting the bill.
Okay, please proceed and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Greg Johnson. I'm here today representing the Association of Minnesota Building Officials. I am a municipal building inspector. What we're really trying to address here is the circumstance by which there are no minimum requirements for the inspectors who work for a designated building official in Minnesota. This is fairly atypical for a state that has a statewide building code, as does Minnesota, which covers jurisdictions of 2,500 or larger. If you look at the state of Florida, state of South Carolina, state of North Carolina, state of Ohio, state of New Jersey, state of Wisconsin, state of California, state of Utah, they all have similar requirements in place. This language has been formulated to require testing by nationally recognized agencies because we would prefer that the people developing these tests be experts in the science of test development and administration.
Yep. Any questions from members? Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't have any questions until you mentioned that the reason Minnesota needed to do this was because we've adopted the statewide building code. I don't believe there are a lot of communities in my district that have adopted the statewide building code. Will this still affect them? How does that work if they haven't adopted that code?
Mr. Chairman, Representative House, if there isn't an adopted building code in place, there's no requirement to have the designated building official. This addresses inspection staff that are working for a designated building official in a community. This would apply to the second person already in the shop. If there's no building department there already, this has no application.
Questions? Representative Goodwin.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. But it also covers, Representative Clinton, it also covers mechanical inspectors, plumbing inspectors, combination, which I need to have defined for me, combination inspectors, and plan examiners. Can you tell me what a combination inspector is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, a combination inspector is the trade jargon that refers to a multidiscipline inspector. It's fairly common in smaller communities for the inspectors to be required to inspect for building code issues, plumbing code issues, mechanical code issues, energy code. The folks that inspect for multiple codes are referred to as combination inspectors. We anticipate that the way this is going to develop is that a test specific to Minnesota, Minnesota's package of regulations will have to be developed to address those inspectors so that we aren't asking people to be tested on regulations that aren't relevant to Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sam Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Klinsing and I were talking, and a big concern of mine is the fact that home inspectors don't have any licensing or certification or any part of that process. Is there any special reason that you didn't put some criteria in here for home inspectors?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I fight with a lot of people currently, and I didn't want to fight with any more. I was trying to address my small piece of the world, but you're not the first person who's urged me to consider that particular discipline for closer examination.
Well,
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make the point that I did meet with the three groups several times, and they hadn't been able to come together on a licensing issue, and were fighting amongst themselves. So I spoke with Representative Klinsing, and she agreed that when this bill gets to the floor, that we could add an amendment that says that the Department of Administration has to determine what kind of licensing, or Department of Commerce, whichever one it would be, would have to determine what kind of, we got to do something about the fact that these folks are inspecting homes, and they don't, it could be you or me, they don't have to have any experience, and yet homeowners are left with quite a mess on their hands a lot of times, so not knowing what they're getting into. So at any rate, that's just the one thing. The other thing I want to find out is, how does this affect people in the building trades and these different inspections that are in rural areas or areas where they would have to come down here to get this, you know, to take their license exams or to take so many classes or to take, is there any way we can protect the people in the construction trades that this is not a convenient thing for them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, currently the way the testing works for the certified building official that is required, designated building official for communities, the Department of Administration actually takes that test around the state to make it more available to people in greater Minnesota to eliminate those travel times. Additionally, the national agencies that provide these types of examinations, if there's enough of a market for it, will, you know, move the test center. Tests are typically offered either paper and pencil or in a computer-based testing format. There are two testing locations, for example, for the International Code Council here in the Twin Cities, and they offer testing pretty much every Saturday. You can call on a Tuesday, I think, and register for a test, any of the tests that organization offers, and take that test on Saturday again. I realize that doesn't address the travel issue, but just the fact that they're offered with that frequency or that availability, I think, helps to mitigate some of that issue.
And then, Mr. Chair, one final question. I'm always concerned with licensing laws and so forth, criteria about protectionism in certain areas. Now, for two questions. One is this, are city inspectors going to be included in this? Because I think we have a number of problems with city inspections as well. And also, is this going to reduce the field in any way of available people?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, if by city inspectors do you mean any construction code inspector employed by a city who was hired after July 1st of 2007 would have to comply with this set of rules. So if you were a municipal building inspector, you would have to comply with this set of rules. We went with testing or competency based on testing specifically to address the concern of that we don't want to restrict the pool of available candidates. And going back to my earlier question where I pointed out that you can register on Tuesday and test on Saturday, and if you're an unsuccessful candidate, do that same thing again, I believe, within a month. The idea is to make this as available as possible. We have no desire to restrict the pool of candidates for this, and we haven't established any kind of minimum prerequisites to sit for the test. But we're placing our faith in is that if you are capable of sitting down with the code, which is some very highly technical writing, and using that document to pass the certification test, that you have met the minimum level of competency required of you when you're going to go into the field with that code book and try to explain exactly the intent of that document to the regulated party.
Thank you.
Any further questions by members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that raises a question in my mind. Does this kind of create a cottage industry in test prep people?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, there are any number of cottage industries existing already for test preparation. The intent is not to create that. However, at the same time, I'm sure most of the people in the room have invested at one time or another in their personal education to prepare their professional goals. And if people have to do that within my profession, good.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clinton.
Just to answer that, I hope there already is a cottage industry prepping these folks for inspecting the homes, because they need to know the code and be doing the inspections and to be up on that. Maybe there's already an industry out there that's getting them ready to go in there and be ready to inspect.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clinton, I think. I have two questions, one of which is regarding the fee, the $70 fee. Is that designated as to where that goes? Does that just go into the general fund, or does it go specifically towards funding this particular program? And the second question is just, you know, and this is more for the testifier, if you could clarify just the ramifications for counties that do not have building codes.
Representative Clinton.
The fee is for the examination costs to make this fiscally neutral. And it'll go into the Department of Administration's special revenue fund to administer the test.
Mr. Johnson, you want to take a second question?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Representative, again, this has no application in jurisdictions that haven't yet adopted the state building code, and doesn't have an application in a jurisdiction that only employs a single person to address these issues, because that person already is required to be certified and they are the designated building official of that community. So how it impacts counties, it's going to depend upon, for example, I believe Goodhue County, Rice County have adopted the state building code countywide, and then there are individual jurisdictions within the county that also administer the building code. So in those jurisdictions, there is a designated county building official, and those counties would have to comply with these requirements.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'm trying to figure out exactly what this does cover. Are electrical inspectors covered by this?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mowry, we did not address electrical inspectors because there's already a requirement in statute that electrical inspectors be licensed as electricians and they have a continuing education requirement in place. So we felt that there was adequate protection between the state licensing and the continuing education requirement, that there was already adequate protection for the public through that route.
Mr. Chairman, just continuing. Are fire inspectors included?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mowry, no, they are not.
Mr. Chairman, why?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mowry, I would reference my earlier question about the number of people I am engaged currently in convincing to see things my way. My personal opinion would be that fire inspectors should be included, but I would leave that to the Fire Marshals Association of Minnesota to address, and I wouldn't presume to carry their ball.
Mr. Chairman, I think if we're doing something, we either should be doing it or not, and I think that's certainly just because they might have a political opposition to you doesn't mean that it should be either. This sounds like it's something that we should be doing or shouldn't be doing. What about plumbing inspectors? Where do they stand under this bill?
Johnson.
Mr. Chairman,
like they're included in this, that they'd be in.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mowry, currently plumbing inspectors would be required to comply with the requirements of this language. We are in a conversation with the Minnesota State Pipe Trades about addressing plumbing inspectors in the same way or in a similar way to that we've addressed the electrical inspectors, because they do have a statewide licensing program, but using provisions of this bill then to ensure the continuing education in code would be in place to try and address some of our specific concerns.
Chairman, if they're licensed by the health department, that's my understanding, I think I remember, aren't they still at health that they're licensed by?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Robert, that's correct.
So if the health department licenses them and thinks that they're okay up to date, you still don't think that they're okay, that our health department isn't sufficient at doing, watching out for us, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mowry, there's a distinction between being licensed perform the work and being being a person who verifies the work. I'm not going to suggest that most licensed plumbers wouldn't be capable of being plumbing inspectors. That would be absurd. I think that is true. I do think that, though, that there are people working in the crafts and the trade that probably haven't kept up with the code as well as they should have. I don't think that either of those things, though, have an impact here. I think we're willing to consider a state licensed plumber as falling into these requirements as long as we can guarantee the continuing education piece. Because that's how we pick up the folks that may not be current, and that's what we want to do. In the construction industry, there's a world of change always in front of us in terms of technology, materials, the way we do things. And my understanding of licensing through the Department of Health is that once you have your license, be it a license from 1962, a license from 1972, a license from 1982, that's all you have to do is do that one piece. So if we can address plumbing inspection in the same way that electrical is addressed with continuing education requirements to make sure that that person who's already learned the craft and trade of plumbing, as long as we can make certain that they're in those continuing education classes to stay up with the advances in technology and the way the code changes with those advances in technology, I certainly would be comfortable in addressing that.
Yes, Representative Mullery, and then we got Representative Liebling, and then we've got the ever exciting weights and measures bill next.
Representative Mullery. Quite a few, Mr. Chairman. It's now, what do they have to do to get whatever it's called from your competency certification or whatever it's called? What background do they have to have for that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, really, as we were looking to the minimum standard, there's no particular background required. What you have to have is you have to have the ability to take the examination and pass the test. And typically these things are challenging enough, and the subject matter itself is technical enough that in of itself proves your ability to use the document, the code book, in the same way in the field.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'd feel probably a lot safer with having somebody with a lot of experience and maybe not having read up on the code book. I know from other areas of practice that's certainly true. What are we talking about? My understanding, I'm trying to figure out what this completion of a mandatory training program, who's going to get the money for that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, this piece of the language was designed to create more flexibility for the Department of Administration. Currently, the Department of Administration is required to retest or to test individuals who may have already obtained national certifications as building officials. Somebody who's a certified building official nationally comes to Minnesota, we require them to take the Minnesota test over again. And that seemed like that was maybe too much of a barrier or additional barrier to that person working in Minnesota, because these people have already demonstrated technical ability. The idea of the mandatory training program was so that the Department of Administration could take somebody like that who's already demonstrated that they've got the technical competencies, and they could run through a 2-hour, 4-hour, maybe a whole day training session on the administrative portions of the Minnesota codes and any specific Minnesota amendments, just to familiarize them with conditions that were unique to Minnesota. And if I could comment on one statement you made earlier, Representative Mulvery, I believe in experience too. I love experience, but the fact is that in most areas of the state right now, you don't have to have the experience or have passed the test. That's what we're trying to address.
Mr. Chairman, so there's no, you're talking about continuing there's nothing thought of as any type of training that'll be you talked about continuing training.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulvery, I think all of these nationally recognized certifications, in order to maintain your certification, require continuing education units. So it's not just that what we're saying is that a person who currently doesn't have to meet any requirements, it's not just that they have to pass the test, but what we're saying to them is, look, you need to spend 2 or 3 days a year in education so that you're really current on what the codes are, what the materials are, what these systems that are going into people's homes and businesses and the places where we assemble, that you really stay up and on top of your profession. we view the continuing education portion of this to be of significant benefit to the public in Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, what is the... I assume the cities are going to have to pay for this. How much is that going to, since it's required of their inspectors, how much is this going to cost cities then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mowry, there's a wide range of education out there. The state of Minnesota itself offers continuing education seminars in the spring and in the fall, 2 different days per year for the very low cost of $35 a day. And then, of course, you do have to, I mean, calculate that a person will be out of the office that day, so you don't have their labor within the jurisdiction that day. A typical day of education in our profession usually runs between maybe $80 and $120 a day, $100 average.
Mr. Chairman, so we would be...
Representative Muller, do you have another question?
I've got considerable questions, Mr. Well,
okay, we do have... we are running against the clock here, and we do have another bill up.
Yes,
so
Mr. Chairman.
If it does have another stop to go, and maybe you could talk with the author if there's some issues that can maybe be worked out. Representative Muller.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to find out... so basically we don't know what unfunded mandates we're passing on to cities yet, but we're supposed to vote on this. Who's going to establish that? Is this another one that's just going to rules without the legislature having much knowledge of what we're doing?
Representative Mullery, this is going to state government finance, so there will be a fiscal note there, and they usually take into account if there's local government fiscal impact at that point.
Mr. Chairman, could I comment on that?
Sure, Mr. Johnson.
We charge fees for permits. This is not an unfunded mandate. This is people receiving the protection they have paid for.
Representative Liebling, is it to that point? Representative Rukavina.
Sir, I'm sorry, but when you require the Department of Administration to draft rules, there's going to be a cost to it. And unless you're transferring your fees that you get to the Department of Administration, it's going to cost money.
Representative Rukavina, there's a piece in the bill that cover the cost of the Department of Administration.
Well, he just said that the fees are already being paid.
He was referring to local government costs.
Well, Mr. Chair, the question the Representative Mullery asked was that, how are you going to pay for it? You talked about a fiscal note and everything else, and then the witness said that it's already paid for, the way I heard it.
He's referring to the fiscal cost at the local government level.
And, Mr. Chair, you know, and, sir, I've heard you testify before, and I believe this bill kind of is also looking at the whole mold problem, which we've never addressed and never accomplished and never done anything to address the mold problem. But now all of a sudden we've got licensing of people and nowhere, no money to pay for it to address the mold problem that's never been addressed. So, you know.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, when I commented on building department fees, what I was trying to indicate was that when we issue permits and charge fees for them, an appropriate use of those permit fee revenues is to provide for training of the staff that are engaged in that activity. Regarding state funding, the state does charge municipalities a surcharge on local permit fees, that money goes into a special revenue fund, and that's where at least a portion of the fees for the program would be administered. I will tell you that it wasn't our intent to specifically address mold issues singularly, but that there are any number of important life safety issues out there that we think if we're going to regulate, we should be regulating them with people that have demonstrated some minimum level of competency.
Mr. Chair, there's a city building official here from St. Louis Park who came to make a public comment on this testimony.
Okay, we'll take the testimony. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Brian Hoffman. I work as the Director of Inspections for the City of St. Louis Park, and I'm here representing the city today. And first of all, we're very thankful and appreciative of Representative Klinzing to bring this bill forward. It's long overdue in the profession. Right now, the state of things, and I've been in this business over 20 years, is that a city could, and it's their choice, so hopefully they make wise choices, but you could hire anybody to go out there and be an inspector. Now, we're not just talking about new homes here, we're talking about commercial buildings, office buildings, condominiums, high-rises. Most cities have standards that they want to make sure their inspectors are competent. We train them, we look for the right qualifications, there's a degree program out there now in building inspection that more and more people are taking. A lot of this, though, has been fairly recently developing over the last 10 or 12 years. It's a fairly new profession, actually. We're in a state where we even require licensing of hair stylists, but yet we're not doing anything for code inspectors. Maybe about a dozen years or so ago, as a profession, we started to realize the importance of being uniform. And collectively, at annual schools, we have spent a lot of time working on trying to make sure that inspectors in various cities are looking at the code the same way, so that it's fair, that it's uniform, and people are educated. This has gone a long way, but it's not far enough. We need to raise the minimum standard of the profession that people are in it, have proven some level of competency. Now, obviously, the city can say, well, we want to make sure that anybody we hire has a certain knowledge. The problem is, if other cities, if other counties aren't having that level, we see enforcement that's spotting that's at various levels, and that's a problem for all of us. And so I think that this bill would help, one, raise the standard in the profession. It would help the efforts of uniformity, and many of the inspectors I know are behind this because we have tried different ways of raising the standard, and so I think that the time has come to do this. The issue about cost to the city, first of all, if I was coming to the city and the requirement was I had to be certified, well, just like any other profession, I'm responsible to go out and pay for my certification exam, get the test, and come ready prepared to take a job. We do this in engineering, we do this in a lot of fields. So I don't think this is that much different than what we see in many other professions. And so I want to thank you for considering this.
Representative Liebling.
Given the time, Mr. Chair, I'm going to hold my question and just bring it up with the author.
God bless you. Representative Soderstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I missed the first part of this bill, so I maybe this has been brought up before. All right. I'm a real estate broker, and I've been in real estate for 22 years, and I never used to recommend inspections. And would this not affect people that do inspections for homes or just for the cities?
Representative Klinzing.
This particular bill only addresses the city building officials, so it doesn't address the private home inspectors that you're speaking of. We're saving that for another day.
All right. Well, thank you. I tell you what, it's very much needed because when we get home inspectors for homes, they're not licensed. I have a whole file of people that keep stopping into my office and say, I do home inspections, and they give me their card. They're not licensed, and it's really difficult to know. Very important. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Goodwin renews her motion that House File 1929 be recommended to pass and be referred to State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Gunther. Representative Gunther moves House File 2155 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Opportunity, Finance, and Policy.
Members,
Gunther.
This is the Waste and Measures Bill from the Department of Commerce, and I have amendments A05-02 2245, and that is regarding petroleum inspectors and inspections. And
that get in the shape you want?
That would make it the shape I wanted to have. And
why don't we go ahead and adopt that?
Okay.
First, Representative Gunther moved the A05-0245 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We have today Carol Hockert, who's the Director of Weights and Measure, here to describe the bill section by section, or in due to the lack of time, we could open it up for questions now.
Okay, we've got, I jumped the gun a little bit. There's a few blanks we got to fill in on the amendments. We'll just, I think we can just take those as amendments to the bill since that's been amended. So, Representative Gunther will move these following amendments that are made to the amendment, but basically to the bill. That's clear. On page one, line one should read House File 2155. Line two should say page six after line 27. And then on line three, it should say section eight.
Thank you.
So all in favor of those amendments say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Questions to this exciting weights and measures bill? Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gunther, how long would it take for you to explain everything about this bill?
Longer than we have.
You sure? Over 10 seconds?
Over 10 seconds. I can say that this is a good bill that you'd be proud to have it yourself.
That's all you know about it.
There's still room on the bill for authors, I've noticed. So we could probably get up to another, 34 authors on here?
I think he said all he understands about the bill.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther. Just so that we basically have an overview of what it is, the weights and measures here, is this like the truck weights, or is this the weight, is this the measurement of fuel that's being pumped? But the question I had was that we're adding a new penalty of $100 to $500 on page 6, and I don't know if that means that if you're getting 3/4 of a gallon of fuel at the fuel tank, that looks like a pretty, you know, instead of a full gallon, that seems like a pretty minor penalty. If it applies to, you know, somebody's 100 pounds overweight on the truck axles or something, that might be a different sort of thing. I just want to know the context of that penalty.
Could you introduce yourself? I guess we'll give you that opportunity.
My name is Carol Hockert. I'm with the Director of the Weights and Measures Division. And the citation authority, currently the Weights and Measures Division has in statute that there are misdemeanors for violations of certain weights and measures law, selling something short, like a gallon of gasoline. Normally, right now, we go in and we write up a written warning. If it's the first time something, and it's usually not a 3/4 of a gallon, we might be talking about, you know, fraction, 1/100 of a gallon. After that written warning, if the station or the scale is still not meeting requirements, our options are to take it to a city attorney and prosecute as a misdemeanor. And as you're aware, many city attorneys and county attorneys don't want to prosecute misdemeanors, so our hands are tied as to what's our next step. And so this would give us the authority to write a ticket, basically.
Thank you for that explanation. It sounds reasonable. I just didn't know the context at all.
Sure.
Ms. Hockert, I noticed we're changing the a lot of terminology in here from oxygenate blender to ethanol blender. Is there any other fuels that meet qualification for oxygenate, or is it just ethanol?
Mr. Chair, in Minnesota, we're required to use ethanol as the oxygenate.
No, that was before my time. They snuck that through. Looking for other the there's probably biodiesel. Oh, that's a real great thing too. Anything else? Any further questions?
Great bill, Mr. Chairman. Representative Moe, this is the person you want to talk to about your problem up in your district.
Thank you, Mr. Representative. We already have.
Okay, good.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. I needed some clarifying in the very beginning part where it talks about delaying the repeal of petroleum tank release cleanup provisions. What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Pearson. I'm the director of the Petrofund program at the Department of Commerce. And the Petrofund program was created by the legislature in the late 80s to address leaking petroleum storage tanks. And since we started work 15 years ago, we've had over 16,000 petroleum leaks reported in our state. We spent about $355 million cleaning up or reimbursing tank owners for that work. We've done a great deal of work, but we still have a fair amount to go. So when that legislation was originally passed, there was a sunset provision put on the program with the idea that we would be able to work ourselves out of a job. And so what is happening here is we are raising that question again and asking for another 5 years to continue our work.
Representative Davis? Representative Goodwin?
Yeah.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gunther, thank you for such a wonderful bill. I've read it, and I anticipate a very excited vote on this. Anxiously awaiting my vote, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Simpson.
Representative Gunther, thank you. For most people sitting around this table, they probably don't understand this at all. I happen to be in the gas business, and I happen to work with Weights and Measures. I've worked with the Petrofund, and this is a good bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, I totally agree with you.
Ms. Hockert, on page 17, under the diesel fuel oil, we're not making the biodiesel mandate kick in any sooner, are we?
No, sir, we are not.
Okay, the later the better, in my opinion. Painful chapter in my history. Any other questions? Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Gunther renews his motion to the House File 2155. Be recommended to pass and re-refer to Jobs, Economic Opportunity, Policy, and Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
And it does not look like we need to meet tomorrow, so enjoy your day. We are adjourned.